The business of culture, the culture of business, media and entertainment, markets, policy and politics, creatives, iconoclasts, authors. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad, and we are live in Richmond with NPR's Sarah McCammon.
Evangelicalism was on the rise, and there was a growing movement of evangelical leaders, people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and others, who were mobilizing this religious group as a political force. And they were doing it through things like Christian broadcasting. Christian radio was on all the time in my house. You know, a whole infrastructure of institutions, you know, not just books and magazines, like I mentioned, but all sort of alternative schools and think tanks. And it became, you know, a massive political movement, which, you know, arguably culminated in 2016.
That's right. The national political correspondent on her new book, The Ex-Vangelicals. You do not want to miss this. Stay with us. Full disclosure proudly airs on WVTF Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news station, online at radioiq.org. And special thanks to our host tonight, Fountain Bookstore and Sam Miller's Restaurant. Visit them online and in person in Richmond's historic Shaco Slip. Joining me live from historic Shaco Slip in Richmond, Virginia, where, no joke, Pat Benatar used to gig, NPR's Sarah McCammon, author of the new book, The Ex-Vangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Welcome, Sarah. Your book, which just dropped, was exceedingly candid and intimate. First, I have to ask you to unpack the term evangelical. I mean, so much cognitive dissonance, and it's been co-opted in so many
ways. Would basically say that evangelicalism, at least as we think of it today, is usually centered around a conservative version of Protestant Christianity. And increasingly, over my lifetime in particular, it's become more and more associated with the political movement. But it started out as a theological movement. And, you know, there is a history in evangelicalism long ago of activism toward social justice. It's taken on a different form. And, you know, my book really kind of paints a granular picture of what it was like to grow up in that world, particularly in the 80s and 90s, at a time when the moral majority was on the rise.
So you're coming of age in this. I gather you are what? Are you an old millennial, a young millennial?
I'm an old millennial.
So you were born in the early... You were born in the early 80s, and looking back, I mean, Ronald Reagan was considered controversial back then, a divorcee. And for the moral majority to congeal over the next 40 years was not in no ways kind of preordained. They say, who has the more difficult time of building a coalition in your day job at NPR Politics, the Democrats or the Republicans? But the grand prize has always been the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which you covered.
Right. And white evangelicals have been a reliable voting bloc for the Republican Party for many years now throughout my life. And that's something that really we started to see on the ascent, like I said, about the time that I was born. In 1981, I was born about 2 weeks after Ronald Reagan was sworn in. And again, that was the time that the moral majority and other groups were mobilizing around these issues, including abortion. The goal was always to overturn Roe v. Wade. And as we saw, that happened in 2022.
You hit at a lot of cognitive dissonance in this book, especially since 2016, the biggest political upset in history. I mean, nobody even, you know, into the hours right before the election had predicted that an upset like that could happen. And clearly, the Electoral College was in play. And then who could have imagined if I told you just 10 years ago that former reality star, New York City developer, bon vivant Donald Trump would deliver the reversal of Roe v. Wade, would deliver the majority of the court to a coalition that couldn't be kept together by Mitt Romney or various other people that you covered. How do you, I'm sure you think about this a lot and you discuss it in the book. It requires such a leap of faith to look at a Donald Trump as a kind of a vessel for the Christian community, as a believer.
Well, you know, I want to go back a little bit to sort of why I wrote the book to answer that question. You know, I have my own personal history with the evangelical movement, as I described. That was something that I had kind of gradually and painfully moved away from in really my early 20s. So we're talking 20 years ago. I was then assigned to cover the 2016 campaign and specifically the Republican primary. I thought that would mean covering probably Jeb Bush as the Republican nominee. Obviously, that didn't happen.
Right.
But so much of the reporting, because of the dominance of the white evangelical movement in the GOP, so much of the reporting by myself and my colleagues centered around what will white evangelicals do? Because, as you say, there seemed to be sort of a dissonance there between what Trump stood for and what the movement stood for. I talk in the book about, you know, my very clear memories of being a teenager in the 90s and hearing evangelical leaders talk about character and their concerns about Bill Clinton's moral failings. And so the question was, how will they respond to someone like Donald Trump? And as we saw, there was, you know, there was some hand-wringing about that, but ultimately the white evangelical movement resoundingly supported him. 8 out of 10 white evangelical voters in both 2016 and 2020, according to exit polling, supported him. And we see today in the 2024 primaries that white evangelicals were a huge force in making him the presumptive nominee once again. It does seem like an incongruity. It did to a lot of people. But as you point out, there was some history there. It wasn't the first time that white evangelicals had supported a candidate who maybe didn't line up with their moral beliefs. And I think I explain it, and I think scholars that I have read and cited in my book as well explain it in this way, which is Trump was looking for a base, and white evangelicals were looking for a champion for their causes, including the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But this was also a movement that had been building and building as the country became more diverse, less religious, and really, as white Christians started to see their cultural power declining.
I want you to take me back to your childhood. And when I read about things like this, the way in which you illustrate how your pop culture consumption, your educational consumption, everything was hermetically sealed. The youth magazines had to be pre-approved. There was nothing like the World Wide Web or the smartphone or things kind of wafting in and offering you, you know, potentially subversive ideas. Illustrate that for everybody out there.
Yeah, so as I was growing up, my entire world was an evangelical bubble. What one of the women I interviewed who identifies as an ex-evangelical described as a parallel universe. So I went to Christian school. I was taught with textbooks that were written by Bob Jones University, which was famous for a very long time, prohibiting interracial dating. Of course, it allows it now, but had a long history of discrimination in that way. And also another sort of similar college, Pensacola Christian, which produced many, many textbooks for Christian schools and homeschools. And, you know, those textbooks contained a lot of things, including teaching, you know, young earth creationism. I was taught that the Bible is literally true, that it is, you know, it's not just metaphor. It's all tantamount to a science book, and that the earth was no more than 10,000 years old. Those books, which I bought a bunch of and cited for this book, they, you know, contained a lot of ideas that I now recognize as portraying a really sort of traditionalist view of gender and leaving out a lot of American history, a lot of the ugly parts of American history, quite frankly. But it wasn't just that. It was, we had Christian books, Christian movies, Christian magazines, and I really knew very few people who didn't think like we did. A central character in the book is my grandfather, who was the only non-religious person I really knew well, and who came out later in life as gay. And, you know, I talk about the tension that created in my family and the struggle to kind of, for my parents, it was a real problem. For me, it created a lot of tension. How do I regard him given what I'm being told about the world? And so when I heard the term ex-evangelical, I heard this term while I was covering the Trump campaign from some evangelicals.
I mean, it was a hashtag.
It was a hashtag. Yeah. It's become a huge hashtag online.
There are all sorts of podcasts about it.
Exactly. When I heard that word, it resonated for me because it kind of said, I was part of this community once and now I'm not. And, you know, what I want to make sure I'm clear about is this isn't just about Donald Trump, but I think the moment, the last few years have really sort of forced a reckoning for a lot of people with what that term means. And for those who grew up like I did, immersed in that world, many are starting to say, you know, this isn't a term that, a label that aligns with who I am.
I was surprised in how your parents had their moment of epiphany and realization, especially in that your father, I mean, his father became was a product of medical school and was a devout atheist or anything, but was not religious. And you said your mother comes from a Lutheran background, and they came together, and I guess a transcendental moment put them on this path of, you know, rigid Christ worship and actually almost paranoia about the world outside, or we have to solve things, or we have to fix things. How, you know, explain how that path, how that moment, how that time together then resulted in them committing their lives and their children's lives to this.
Yeah, well, I thought hard about what to say about my parents in this book because I wanted to tell my story.
Sure.
And in order to tell my story about my childhood, I had to talk about them. And so I'm hesitant to speak for them, but what I was told and what I understood growing up was that they had a meaningful conversion experience, that it had felt life-changing, and that it sort of defined who they wanted to be going forward. And what I also know is that at that time, again, this was the late 70s, early 80s, when they were getting married and starting their family, evangelicalism was on the rise, and there was a growing movement of evangelical leaders, people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and others, who were mobilizing this religious group as a political force. And they were doing it through things like Christian broadcasting. Christian radio was on all the time in my house. And also, a whole infrastructure of institutions, not just books and magazines, like I mentioned, but all sort of alternative schools and think tanks. And it became, a massive political movement, which, arguably culminated in 2016.
And there were always, fits and starts. You would hear about Ralph Reed and Dobson and the various third party movements that would come out of this because the big tent GOP couldn't go too far to the right. And then there was a looking back as a student of history, and Mitt Romney could the Baptist South kind of suborn a Mormon candidate. I can't get over it. Trump is such a through line in this book. You've covered him so much that if you would have told me that this would have been the vessel, I guess vessel is the word, the vehicle for evangelical efficacy.
I mean, that obviously surprised a lot of people. But once again, I think we heard things from evangelical leaders like, we're not looking for a pastor. We need a president. We need he's a politician. He's someone who can deliver on our political goals. When I would talk to voters in 2016 at rallies, I would ask them about this question, particularly those who said something about a religious faith. I would ask them, how do you feel about Trump's rhetoric about immigrants or his rhetoric about women or his rhetoric about disabled people? Again and again, I would hear things like, well, I wish he would not tweet so much, or I wish his tone were a little different. But fundamentally, they had the sense that the country was going the wrong direction and that Trump was someone who could stand in the gap in a way and stop it. And I mean, this way of thinking and the slogan, Make America Great Again, it really aligned with many of the things I'd heard growing up and read in those textbooks. I mentioned that they painted a frankly inaccurate picture of American history. They talked about America as a Christian nation that was chosen by God, that was specially ordained. And, that was what we were taught in our classroom as just sort of a fact about the world and the country, with relatively little attention to the injustices that accompanied the founding of our country, including the treatment of Native Americans and the history of slavery. I mean, we touched on those things, but I quote some passages that I almost hate to repeat that are in this book, just painting a glowing picture of, for example, the South.
The South and the climate, and it was good for the slaves' health.
Yeah, and so, going back, I was thinking about what I wanted to say when I wrote this book. Like, what was it from my childhood? I was seeing all these people, many of them of my generation, using this hashtag exvangelical, talking about deconstruction, which is sort of a new word, a language that's developed for talking about this process that I went through many years ago and didn't have words for then. And I was, I was thinking about all of my memories and what were the tension points for me, what were the things that didn't add up for me. And there were many of the same themes that I was seeing in these online spaces and Facebook groups, on TikTok, on podcasts, et cetera. But I wanted to sort of check my memory of it because it's like, it was long ago and, was it really the way I thought it was? And when I ordered all of these textbooks, I went online and I just looked, I eyeballed the covers and I said, okay, I had that one. And as I was going through them and reading lines like that, it was really stark to think that that is what we were being taught.
Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad. You're listening to NPR's Sarah McCammon. She's author of the new book, it's about to become a bestseller, The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. We're doing this show live at Sam Miller's restaurant in Shaco Slip. We're hosted by Fountain Bookstore, the wonderful indie But Ulrich goes back to 1978. Sarah, while I have you in your mellifluous voice here, I would love for you to read a passage from your book, as a lot of people are lined up to buy it.
I'm going to start. I have a couple that I could read from, but I want to start with one that I think just sort of sets the scene and describes that world that I grew up in. This is from chapter one. It's called People Need the Lord, which if you grew up evangelical, you'll probably recognize that as a song. Dear Lord, I prayed, thank you for this food and for this day. And I pray that Grandpa will get saved. In Jesus' name, amen. Every night, the six of us, my parents, two sisters, my brother, and me, gathered around our antique wooden kitchen table, and someone prayed a version of that prayer for my grandfather. I didn't know much about him, only that his house was filled with interesting objects and artwork and books, and that he played classical music on the grand piano in his living room, that the kitchen smelled of garlic and sherry from his beloved cooking projects, and that he always had at least one cat lurking around the house. I knew that he was a brain surgeon, and I understood that was something we were proud of. But I couldn't understand why he didn't love Jesus, the man with the gentle face surrounded by the herd of fluffy sheep in the tiny framed painting on my bedroom shelf. What I did know was that Grandpa and my aunts and uncles were going to hell. Like everyone who didn't believe in Jesus, their souls were in great danger. We had to pray for them, my parents told us. And whenever we saw them, we had to be a witness, to be friendly, respectful, and well-behaved so as to show them the light of Jesus. Being evangelical meant evangelizing, sharing the news of Jesus with everyone we could before it was too late. And this was especially urgent for the people we loved most, our family. If they could see Jesus shining through us, they might be drawn to him and understand that they were lost in the darkness, and that if they would simply believe and pray to receive him into their hearts, they could become better people here on earth, and then, when they died, go to heaven with us. Though we feared an eternity of separation from our family members who would be in hell while we were in heaven, my parents seemed cautious about spending time with them while we were together here on earth. Grandpa lived only a few miles away, but we didn't see him much, mostly at holidays and major family gatherings. No sleepovers, no group vacations, no hanging out at Grandpa's house. We probably spent more time there for the few years of my life when my grandmother, whom I called Mima, was alive. But that's only a fuzzy memory of a memory. She was gone not long after my third birthday. So on the occasions we visited Grandpa's house, I was on my best behavior. The stakes could not have been higher. My childish disobedience, even my failure to exhibit the joy of Jesus that should clearly be radiating from my heart, could cost my relatives their very souls. Carrying that heavy truth, I put on a smile.
And when I think back to that part, I immediately think to you being sent to Washington, D.C., what were you, 16? Mm-hmm. Was that the summer of 1997?
98, yeah, I turned 17 there.
Therein is a leap of faith, because that you're going to be amongst other people and not witness certain things that you did. I mean, you're in this dorm with strict rules. It's a former funeral home, am I
yes.
right? I mean, it's almost written like a sitcom. And you have...
It's still there.
people who are hungover or vomiting in bags, uh-huh. other contemporaries of yours saying, wondering if they skipped a menstrual cycle or there were other things going on. And you, for that fleeting moment, you had this resolve, but you were also... You were giving consideration to a moment of lust or letting your mind wander in that this is an open book. I mean, discuss that.
Yeah. I mean, I was for the first time surrounded by kids who did not believe like I did, kids of all different faiths and no faith. I looked on those things, my dorm mates who were worried about maybe, getting pregnant who were drinking. I looked down on them because I had been taught that we lived the right way and that, if you just followed all the rules, you wouldn't have to worry about those things. And I mean, I will say it's not a bad idea to to follow some rules when you're a teenager, but this was just a whole other world for me. I had never been around kids who even remotely partied. And, I felt a little superior, but I also, I was a teenager. I was aware of sexuality, obviously, and my sexuality. And, knowing that some of my peers were engaged in that was kind of like, on the one hand, I was judging them, but on the other hand, I was totally fascinated, and it was this real conflict. But I think that semester, on the one hand, I have to credit my parents for letting me go because they were pretty protective and they did shelter me. But they let me go do this, I think, because they saw it as part of a larger mission of, you know, engaging with the culture and engaging with politics, and sort of part of training me along with lots of other evangelical young people to help build this, frankly, more Christian nation. So they let me go, and it was eye-opening. You know, it was, on the one hand, I felt very different. I felt very other, at times jealous, at times judgmental of my peers. But it was one of the first times that I really had close interactions with people my age who believe differently.
And so tell me about that, especially the Iranian young man who, you know, put it point blank to you. Do you think I'm going to hell? You were friends with an Iranian Muslim. I mean, these are uncomfortable questions in Richmond, where you are right now. There's always these kind of bless your heart, bless your soul moments. And, you know, polite Southern Christianity and all that stuff. But this is point blank.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We were obviously taught pretty explicitly that everybody else was going to hell, but it wasn't something other than in moments when we would sort of evangelize. There's this idea of witnessing and sharing our faith with people. And, you know, when I was a teenager, at least one retreat, we went out on the streets in Kansas City and handed out these tracts because we were supposed to share the gospel. But it wasn't like something we did every day. And so, yeah, in polite company, you don't tell people that normally. But I had this friend who was a fellow page by age. We were good friends. He was somebody I really, really liked and admired. And he was from an Iranian Muslim family. And, you know, one day we were sitting on the steps of the Senate rostrum, which is, if you watch on C-SPAN, you know, those little steps, you can see the little pages in their blue suits sitting on them. Yeah. If any of you have worked in D.C., you know what I'm talking about.
I mean, this Strom Thurmond story is hilarious, that you're all warned that he's lecherous. I don't want to ruin it for anyone there. But this is a not to castigate the dead or anything, but here you are, a figure that stood up, you know, for segregation and everything. And meanwhile, he was doing different things behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And
he was he was in his later years by that point.
And still hitting on young teenage.
We were still warned about him. That's true. But the story about my friend, we were talking about our backgrounds, and somehow I think we got to talking about our religious backgrounds and our family backgrounds like a couple of teenagers do. And he did. He asked me point blank, do you think I'm going to hell because I'm a Muslim? And it was just, I just didn't know what to do with that question. Like, I knew what I was supposed to say. I knew what my church would say. But saying it to another person didn't feel right. And I also kind of felt like, I don't think I believe this. And so that was, you know, that was an important moment for me, because it was really this kind of bold, direct question from my friend. And, you know, I didn't think to ask him if I was going to hell because I was a Christian, which is, you know, another piece of it, if you think about it. But, you know, I talked to him recently, and I told him how much that friendship had meant to me, because if you're not exposed to people different than you, if you're in a bubble, it's very easy to think just about anything.
And that's the interesting thing, is I think about going to college and, you know, back, you know, moral majority people were there. People wouldn't proselytize to us necessarily, but you were taking a risk as parents by sending your children to an environment where they're supposed to be steeped in difference, where for the first time in your life, you know, back in my generation, you'd meet people who were openly gay, or you'd meet people who were very vociferously atheist or had differing opinions and things, and you were steeped in that, and especially in the work world. I mean, you come to NPR, to the mothership, what, in 2015, after working at member stations, and that normalizes things more than anything else. In the working world, when you had an art department and a photo department and other editors who are of various persuasions getting your back, you really feel like a family at that point.
Yeah, and I, you know, by the time I came to NPR, I had a long, many years of sort of processing my childhood and thinking hard about what I really thought, and had come to sort of a more complicated place with my own faith. And, you know, really, I went into journalism in many ways because I think I wanted to get away from ideology. I wanted to get away from advocacy. And there are some people that go into journalism, or especially, you know, certain forms of it, I think for the opposite reason.
Your father called NPR
National Perverted Radio.
Oh, that's amazing. That's incredible.
I mean, I asked him about this, and he doesn't remember
it,
but he said, it's possible I said it. That's what I remember. but yeah, it was, you know, there is advocacy journalism, but I didn't want to do advocacy journalism. I wanted to get into journalism because it was a place where asking questions was built in to the system. It was valued. It was a virtue. It wasn't something that we were discouraged from doing. In fact, you had to ask questions, and you had to consider multiple points of view in order to do your job well. And for me, that was, I think, really refreshing. And it was also in my early 20s, you know, long before I came to NPR, when I was still thinking through a lot of things, and even feeling sort of uncomfortable with the fact that I was probably, I thought that evolution was probably okay, but I wasn't sure I wanted to say that out loud, you know. And then to cover science stories as a brand new reporter was just, for me, it was like I was constantly learning, and it was a space where I could let my curiosity sort of lead. And that was really refreshing and new.
Full disclosure, stay with us. Full Disclosure podcast to NPR, Spotify, all fine podcatchers, including and especially Apple Pods. The link is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. We are proudly on NPR mega member station WVTF Radio IQ across the great Commonwealth, Virginia's NPR news station. You could catch us in Asheville, North Carolina on WPVM, out west in Ventura County on KPPQLP. Holler if you too would like us on your air. My DMs are always open at handle FullDRadio. If you are just joining us, my guest is Sarah McCammon, author of the new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Try to say that five times backwards. We are live at Sam Miller's restaurant in historic Shaco Slip, Richmond, Virginia, as hosted by Fountain Bookstore. I have to fast forward you in the book to January 6th. I mean, I was recording a podcast with someone from the Wall Street Journal while that was happening. And I remember as the photos came, as I was reading this book, I thought about, you know, especially ended up who you married and the discussion of Judaism and the mezuzah and everything. There's actually a tableau, if you look at it, of a guy from Delaware, he's since been arrested, coming in, storming, I think, into the Senate with a Confederate flag. And sitting next to him is an Orthodox Jew from Brooklyn with a police barricade wearing a pelt. Never the twain shall really meet. And if you look at the side photo next to them, there was somebody positioned outside to storm that area to come in that had a t-shirt on that said Camp Auschwitz. If there ever was a metaphor for the unusual coalition of people who bought into, and you mentioned this in another interview, Kellyanne Conway's fateful words, alternative facts. I mean, the leaps of faith of things that you can believe. I hate using the verb weaponize, but when you are given that ability to say, no, I don't have to believe that the world is round, or I don't have to believe that this happened. I don't have to believe the election results, that it's actually quite dangerous, blind faith.
Well, you mentioned January 6th, and that event and those images, particularly the Christian images, were part of the reason I decided to write this book. I had been thinking for a long time about the really strange and kind of unexpected intersection of my personal backstory and my professional life. You know, once again, I found myself covering all of these issues and concerns and players that had been so central in my childhood as I was covering the 2016 campaign. But I wasn't sure what I wanted to say. I didn't want to write a pure memoir, and I didn't want to write a campaign book because there are a lot of those. But I would be asked all the time, you know, by people who knew how I'd grown up, well, what do you see here? How do you make sense of this? How do you explain it? And I was not at the Capitol on January 6th. I was covering the Georgia Senate runoff. But actually, I was at a Trump rally just before, I think it was January 4th or 5th, because, you know, Georgia was having that pivotal Senate election that same week, right? There were the two Senate seats at stake.
Yeah.
And so Trump did a rally in support of the Republican candidates. And I remember talking to people, and I have some tape of this that went on Here and Now the next day, you know, talking to people who were talking about how they were going to go to the Capitol, and they were going to, you know, it wasn't clear what they were going to do, but they were talking about being willing to fight. And I didn't know what was coming, but the next day it became really clear as I was driving across the state of Georgia, listening to our live special coverage of the attack. And then to see those images, you know, of crosses and signs that said Jesus saves. I think for anybody with a Christian background and who takes those images seriously and to whom they mean something, I think for many of us, it was kind of stunning. Although not entirely surprising, given the increasing rhetoric around Christian nationalism that we were seeing then, certainly are seeing now. To your point about alternative facts, you know, this is something I talk about in the book as well. Just the sense that for me growing up, there were alternative facts that we sort of, including our views of science, you know, that we sort of accepted as reality. And often if facts intruded that contradicted the narrative, they were rejected. This is why there were entire textbooks and just an entire infrastructure of knowledge and information that was set up to sort of protect this
in parallel
worldview.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I was also struck in the ensuing dragnet after January 6th with the Justice Department. You've covered this. The crowdfunding apparatus invokes Christianity a lot. if you notice, like Christian fundraising for the hostages, the political prisoners of January 6th, I mean, it continues. Even after the violence, even after some people attacked Capitol police officers or were at the very least, you know, uncivil and unchristian, Christianity was yet invoked to raise money for their defense.
Yeah, and that's nothing new. I think that Republican politicians in particular, and some on the left as well, have been invoking religion for many years. And, you know, I think there's an interesting debate to be had about how much we should talk about religion in politics. I mean, there are efforts on the religious left to say, to push back against the Republican narrative and to say, no, you know, Christianity is really about feeding the poor and helping the stranger and loving your neighbor. And, you know, I'm a journalist, so I am not going to comment on what strategy is right or what philosophy is right, but I think it's an interesting debate. Like should anybody be making those arguments? I can understand strategically why the left would want to push back on the idea that Christianity is this one thing that the right tries to perpetuate. But it's not new, but it is a message we've heard from Trump a lot, this idea that once again, there's like this existential threat that the country is in danger, that he can save it, and that he is going to protect Christians is a promise that he's made more than once, and that many of his supporters seem to accept.
I sometimes come in on tangent on this show because I like to open up kind of the thought bubbles or the parenthetical asides when I'm reading a book like this. I was like, in that you cover politics intimately and you host the NPR Politics podcast, do you ever just want to wonk out and go back and look at the electoral results of 1976? And yes, it was a peculiar time after Watergate.
Not really, Robin.
But you do you. Jimmy Carter, a pious guy with a peanut farm and dedicated his life and everything and won over swaths of the South. You would not recognize states that are now ruby red, that, you know, back then it wasn't as political a thing. And there was the declension of the Democratic Party over decades. But now they fairly, you know, you talk about the analysis in this and the people in exit polls who, you know, vote in the primaries for Trump. It's exceedingly kind of red state and evangelical cleave together.
Yeah, and I think, you know, historians like Randall Balmer have written quite a bit about this and about the transition that took place around that time, when, you know, the sort of shift from Carter to Reagan and the mobilization of the religious right. What my book is really about is what it's like to grow up inside that world that was being created then. And, you know, what that felt like, what that looked like, the information sort of sphere that surrounded us. And then, you know, as I've said, the reality that for many people who've come of age in a time where information is readily accessible, where we have an increasingly diverse society, where, you know, if you're told that the earth is 6,000 years old, it's very easy to go online and kind of see that most people with knowledge about these things would say otherwise. And also, you know, I think there's just more understanding about, you know, the fact that not everybody is a cis straight person. You know, if you look at data around even younger evangelicals are much more accepting of same-sex marriage than their older counterparts. And so the culture has shifted a lot in recent decades. And I think it's a fascinating sort of set of cross currents that we're seeing, you know, at the moment that the country is becoming less religious, you know, far less religious than it once was, and much less dominated by white Christianity. We see sort of this zenith, or we saw at least in 2016, of Christian right political power. And observers and scholars like Robbie Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute would argue that those two trends are not, it may seem like a juxtaposition, you know, how strange that white evangelicalism is shrinking and yet more powerful than ever, but that's not an accident. In many ways, Jones and others have argued that the rise of Trumpism is a reaction to the sense of losing cultural power. Mm.
And then as you see some people, even in this demographic decline in terms of clout, and you document in this, what do you call them? The nones, the people who are non-affiliated or don't go
the
to
nuns,
church.
Yeah. The nuns, yeah, N-O-N-E-S.
So, and it's interesting, it's striking in that during this period, there are those on the right who are really doubling down. No, let's smash the taboo. It should be a Christian fundamentalist country. We should restore these values. We should be cautious about the books we have in the public school system or the various things going on in the Deep South. I mean, there's this, it is a paradox in that you have the Supreme Court, you got the ultimate prize in the reversal of Roe v. Wade, which you covered so well for several years. What's left at this point?
Well, I think we're seeing some of it play out with debates around things like IVF.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the controversy in Alabama recently was a really fascinating window into where things could go next, because for many years, opponents of abortion rights. Some of them have said that life begins at conception. That is a moral and frankly often religious point of view. And if one takes that literally, then that has implications for all sorts of medical care, including in vitro fertilization, fertility treatments, as well as potentially some forms of birth control. And so we saw the Alabama Supreme Court say essentially, yes, embryos should be treated like children. And then we saw Republicans very quickly, you know, rush to say, no, that's not what we want to do. That's not the policy that we're going to carry forward. The challenge is, and certainly there's a spectrum within the GOP and within abortion, people who generally oppose abortion, you know, some support just certain restrictions and some support full restrictions. But that sort of underlying philosophy that would say any embryo, any conception is a life, is a person, and has the same rights as anyone else. I mean, that has implications, almost certainly will have implications for other types of care beyond just abortion. And so it's been, I think, fascinating to watch that debate play out, to see the Republican messaging around it. And what I'm curious about is kind of where that goes next. Will the faction of the anti-abortion rights movement that believes in that deeply double down on that policy and on that idea and the policies that would result from it? Or will sort of the more, more moderate Republicans, I suppose, win out in at least in terms of passing some of these protections for things like IVF? You know, I don't know what happened in Alabama was obviously the legislature did pass protections, but I'm just curious where that goes next.
You know, as you describe the book, simultaneous with this period of soul searching and reflection and rediscovering kind of your path and the great wide open, you converge with your grandpa who is ailing. And I always say that a lot of your 30s and even your 40s in my case, maybe this is being indulgent, is unlearning kind of the stuff that was spoon-fed to you in the early decades when you really didn't have a chance. I mean, maybe this is my own psych therapy pro bono to you, but I mean, your grandpa was a huge part of that. And it's not like he could interfere in reverse and kind of stage an intervention for you, that everybody was all hands. We got to pray for grandpa and everything. But you as an adult converged with him where he was and he met you where you were. Talk about that.
Well, as I've mentioned, he was one of the few people I knew growing up who didn't share our religious faith. And we were very concerned about that. And, you know, I tell a story in the book about kind of how I found out that he was gay. It was something that was sort of hidden from me for a long time. And he was sort of kept from me for the most part for many years. We were allowed to see each other, but only on certain occasions. And, you know, I came to find out that there were a lot of rules around that. And we just didn't have a close relationship because of those restrictions. And because my parents, frankly, were concerned that he would be a bad influence on us because of his sexuality. And that was something I had to contend with growing up. I wasn't sure what I thought. You know, I was hearing only one perspective on that for many years. But, I'm very grateful that he lived a very long life. And we did have many years together as an adult. And I was able to sit down with him a couple of times and ask for his thoughts on life and even spirituality. And, you know, it was fascinating to discover that really his view of the world was much more complex than what I'd been told. You know, he had thought deeply about some of these issues, but had just come to different conclusions.
For a searcher, for someone who's trying to synthesize these thoughts, and you explain in the book how you're troubled with it. Some nights you wake up in a sweat. Sometimes you're in a moment of peace. Sometimes you're in a moment of panic or doubt, or did I go the wrong way? You discussed this earlier, the era of social media and the internet, and anybody can Substack or WordPress or share these things. There's unbelievable amounts of candor out there. I mean, slicing and dicing, these people would have had to vie to get some time on NPR 20, 25 years ago. Now there are specific podcasts about this. There are podcasts about, you know, there have been Netflix series about leaving the Orthodox Jewish community. There's an unbelievable system of outreach out there. Again, the hashtag itself, for you to even find people, research, reporting in this thing, it's very different than kind of, you know, making sure your parents aren't watching and going into some musky library and looking for old tomes.
Yeah. I sometimes talk about the fact that when I was growing up, people who left their churches were labeled as backsliding. And, you know, it could be very lonely. And I think this is true of any religious community, any sort of strict or high control, is I think the term that sociologists use, religious community where the boundaries are very carefully policed and there's not a lot of room for dissent. And, you know, I think one of the things that, that I found when I started paying attention to these social media spaces after I heard this term evangelical was that for many people, this was a space where they could find that community around these ideas and have someone else to talk to about, you know, it's really a difficult and complicated process to try to rethink your whole belief system. And so, you know, we're seeing this term deconstruction. I'm seeing it in you know, ex-Mormon communities, ex-evangelical, and so forth. It's not restricted to evangelicals, but that is sort of the main space that I pay attention to. But yeah, I think it's very different. I mean, the internet has changed, obviously, so many things, but it's made that process of leaving a religious community, I think, much easier, and people have resources at their fingertips if they're looking for support or just someone else who's sort of walking the same path.
Full disclosure, do stay with us.
Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad. Our guest is Sarah McCammon, author of The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. We're doing this before an audience at Sam Miller's restaurant in historic Shaco Slip, Richmond, Virginia. Sarah, in the 10 or 12 minutes left we have, I mean, this part of the episode where I called kind of free skate. Some of you grew up with roller skating rinks. I don't know if you were allowed to go to those. You know, at some point the DJ would say, all right, couples off the floor, free skate. Open up your reporter's notebook. Share the things kind of parenthetically with me. I know you're on this rip-roaring tour of the country. You're getting on a crack of dawn plane tomorrow. But you shared some in the acknowledgments, but things you've learned, the people who have reached out to you in the press ever since. I mean, I was stunned to read about, you know, psychosomatic illness, or you talk to therapists. That one therapist in Idaho said, this literally makes some people live in fear or sick. I could tell you there's someone here in attendance who had significant IBS issues growing up because of things like this. Open that up. Kind of if I'm sitting next to you at a wedding or a bar mitzvah on Sunday night, like what are the three things you learned in this process of delivering this book?
I think you're referring to the chapter on religious trauma. And, you know, this is a term that I see a lot in religious deconstruction spaces and ex-evangelical spaces. And it's something that, based on my reporting, there seems to be a growing awareness of among mental health workers. Now, obviously, there's a lot of research that suggests that religious communities can be really helpful and healthy, and they can provide support and meaning and purpose. And I think that's clearly, you know, true. I think for many people they do. But there's a growing awareness that in some cases, that's not so, that often religious spaces can be a place where people experience harm. Now, sometimes that is harm that would be harmful anywhere. I think the sort of paradigmatic example of that is clergy sex abuse. So sex abuse is obviously a trauma, regardless of the context. But when it happens in a space and, you know, is perpetrated by someone who is supposed to be a spiritual guide, someone who's supposed to, you know, not only provide emotional support, but literally people who are supposed to help you connect with God and the divine. For some people, that's a whole extra layer of trauma on top of a trauma. And then for other people, there are, and I think this is more controversial, but I'm saying this based on my reporting on talking to trauma therapists and also to many people I spoke to for the book. And it's a theme I see in many ex-evangelical deconstruction spaces. There are aspects of some of the religious teachings that people feel deeply scarred by. You know, a real emphasis on hell and damnation and, you know, and I understand that that is a part of some religious traditions, but it's one thing to be an adult that, you know, has sort of synthesized your theology. It's another thing to be a little kid that's being told your grandpa's going to hell, you know? And so for many of us, I think there are deep scars from that. You know, I interviewed my brother for this book. He was kind enough to talk to me about some of his experiences around that. And, you know, he talks about being at swim team as like a little kid, like 9 or 10, and just putting his head underwater and not being able to stop thinking about hell and just, you know, these are what trauma therapists would say are classic trauma symptoms. You know, and the thing about it is that we were taught people were going to hell who probably were being taught that we were going to hell. You know, I mean, it's just like, but it's really hard to get those ideas out of your head when you're inculcated with them as a small child. You know, then I talked to several people who were gay, who were raised in these religious communities about the really complicated and painful experience of coming to terms with who they were while being told that that was intrinsically evil. I mean, I interviewed one of my high school friends, Daniel, who who spoke very movingly about that. You know, and I remember him as a little kid. He was a sweet kid. He was kind of a, you know, a loner in some ways, quirky, super smart. And I didn't know what he was going through. But, you know, we talked as 41-year-olds, I think, and he told me about, you know, going into his parents' library and seeing some of these books by evangelical writers that painted this really dire picture of, you know, just a life of loneliness and sickness and death if you were gay. And he internalized that. And you know, it took him many years to sort of figure out how to come to terms with who he was, how to be in relationships, which is also a theme I hear from people, even straight people who were raised in purity culture and told that any kind of sexual activity outside of marriage is a sin and it will doom you and you will have, you know, your future marriage will be scarred by it. You know, I know that people believe these things and people have a right to believe whatever they want, but I also know that many people feel very scarred by them and they're spent a lot of years in therapy talking about them. And so that's why I wrote that chapter.
I want you to talk about, in the sense that you're candid about this towards the end of the book, is Judaism has come into your life. Over the last 10 years. I mean, if I told you again, forget about the Trump thing, you're going to be interviewed in downtown Richmond, Virginia by an Iranian Jew. You will have married a Jewish man on the week that you will be buying Hamantaschen for Purim and your book comes out. I mean, life comes at you fast.
Yeah. And my husband Greg is here. He's Jewish. And I talk about this in the book because I think it just, once again, so much of my book is about how to make sense of difference in the fact that, you know, whoever you are, wherever you're located in the world, whatever you're told as a child, like often the realities of people we meet might not line up with that. And for me, the more that I learn, the more that I open my mind, the more that I embrace people who are different, and the more I've learned about my husband's tradition, which is different from my own, I feel like the more I grow and the more I actually feel joy and excitement about life. For me, anything that closes me off from other people is something I don't want. That isn't right for me. And I didn't write this book to tell anybody what to think or what to believe or who to vote for, but I wrote it because I was seeing something. I was seeing these conversations playing out in the wake of the last 8 years or so that have been such a sort of pivotal and divisive political and social moment in our country. And I was seeing people who had walked the path I had walked talking about it really vocally. And I think the community I come from is, it taught me many things. It's also a uniquely influential community. And so I wanted to explore those themes. And, you know, again, for me, I have landed in a place of trying to sort of open myself and embrace more things. And, but that can be very hard to do because it can be very, very scary if you're told that you shouldn't.
You know, it could also be very scary hosting something like the NPR Politics Pod, which is just this colossus. People binge it in election season. I couldn't live without it in 2020. I remember I'm in my car, you know, contactless pizza, binge eating and everything, and turning that on and listening to Domenico and Susan and everybody else. That's your voice that comes up. And I message you whenever you're hosting a show nationally. And I try to square that with the aperture with which you were given a view of the world initially. And now you are one of the voices of the country and the voices of the world. I know my mind goes in thousands of different places with this, but reflect back on that. I know it's a little cliche to say, what would that, you know, 41-year-old say to that 15-year-old?
I'm 43 now, but when I talked to my friend, I was 41. I have to fact check you because I'm a journalist.
It's all right.
What would I say? I mean, first of all, I thank you. That's very sweet. People overcome all kinds of things in their lives that are much harder than
But do you that. Have out-of-body moments where like, okay, I'm, you know, okay, the NPR Politics Podcast. This is enormously binged, right? We all have smartphones right now. We pay for unlimited data plans. It's not about the primacy of the member station and everything. You should see those numbers in 2020. If somebody's on that, I mean, the people who come on it, 1 week Kamala Harris gets interviewed. I mean, you are one of the primary voices of this major show right now. And I wonder how you take that to bed every night, considering where you came from.
I'm just going to be thinking about you eating pizza now when I record
like
my show.
Like a squirrel. Like.
No, I mean, I feel very grateful. I feel very humbled to have the career that I have. It's in many ways a dream. It's other times, you know, talking about this stuff all the time is actually kind of a drag sometimes. It's very heavy. And, you know, the last 8 years have been so vitriolic that it's not fun every day, but it's fascinating. It's never boring. And I think I would say to my younger self, like, just keep at it. You know, I always loved to write and I loved talking to people and I get to do that for a living and I feel incredibly fortunate.
Can you close us out with some of the outreach you've been getting and kind of with the advanced press on this? The people who can now reach out on Twitter or could DM you on Insta or the various places you talked about the hashtag, it's just been especially trending the past week.
Yeah, I think the last time I checked, which was months ago, there were over 1 billion views for the hashtag Xvangelical on TikTok. They stopped sharing their data now, so it's got to be way over that. There are individual influencers like Abraham Piper, who's the son of a prominent evangelical pastor, John Piper, who has like 1.7 million followers on TikTok. And I just say this to say that there's a big thing happening. Like, there are a lot of people who are having these conversations in these spaces that, as I said, they never could have before. It's been interesting the last few days. I have heard from quite a number of people. I get a lot of DMs on Instagram and Twitter that are basically saying, can't wait to read your book. This is my story too. And that's exactly why I wrote it. I had been meeting people and hearing these conversations for years, but especially the last several years. And I really wanted to say something about it because as somebody who knows what that's like. And I also wanted to write a book that I hope does paint a really specific on the ground picture of the world that I grew up in, because it has been so influential in our politics and culture. And, you know, I think if you understand a little bit about the thinking and some of the ways of seeing the world that many people in my community have adopted, I think it helps to explain a little bit of where we are today. So I hope that it will be useful both for those from this world, this evangelical world, and those on the outside who are trying to understand it. And I also hope that people who are still in evangelical communities or trying to make sense of them will read it. And I don't think it's an anti-religion book at all. I'm not anti-religion. I still believe in God. I don't really care what anyone else believes. Like, I love, I think these are really hard questions and the world's a complicated place. And so I have no like agenda here of what I want anyone to walk out. I have no agenda here for what I want people to think at the end of reading my book. I just hope that it will increase understanding.
Sarah, in closing, what's going to be on your Passover Seder table? I mean, is it an eclectic?
We're going to the West Coast on another leg of the book tour and having Seder with some of my husband's family. So it will be up to them.
Sarah McCammon, author of The Xvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Please give her a hand. Full disclosure, special thanks to our producers, Claire Morgan and Case Graham at Natterly. This show, podcast to NPR, Spotify, and all the podcatchers. The link, again, I expect all of you here to subscribe, is fulldradio.com. Once again, fulldradio.com. Why aren't you typing it into your smartphones? We are on all the social media at handle fulldradio. You can catch news of live shows. We're going to have a whole slate of live shows coming up at the University of Richmond in the fall and the spring. We recently had Steve Inskeep on. I'm going to badger Sarah to maybe do an NPR politics show there. You know, the campus is gorgeous and they all want to see you. And a couple of birthday shout outs. Greg, Mr. McCammon, sir, hubby, happy birthday. We have Joe Crook, happy birthday. If anybody sees LeVar Stoney, mayor of Richmond, tell him happy birthday too. Shout out to our listeners again on WVTF Radio IQ, sponsored the show tonight. And a special thanks to Sam Miller's restaurant, where Pat Benatar used to frequent 4 decades ago, and Fountain Bookstore, my very favorite indie in the heart of Shaco Slip. And you can catch me every week on NPR's Here and Now. I'm Robin Farzad. Thank you for listening, and back with you next week.